All right. Thank you so much. We're on to our next presentation. We have Dr. Dominic Halsmer, Senior Professor of Engineering at Oral Roberts University in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And he is going to speak to us today about engaging scientists and engineers with the gospel.
Thank you, Catherine. I have been blessed to have students, some engineering students, help me with this. Some of my students from seniors down to sophomores, and I'm thinking about this issue. And I'm also blessed to be here with you to help me think about this issue, because I know the Holy Spirit is present in all of our hearts and is going to give us some good truth to understand how we can make a bigger impact. But I think I came up with a better title and talking to my pastor, who turns out also to be my son-in-law, because as I was talking to him about this, reaching scientists and engineers with the gospel, how do we do missions work among scientists and engineers, he reminded me that, you know, everybody's at a different point along the spectrum of belief, and you want to just think about how you can encourage positive movement with each individual or even a people group along that spectrum of belief. And so you could title this talk On the Positive Movement of Techies Along the Spectrum of Christian Belief. And then my other subtitle, I think it's probably not that great, so it's On Saving Spock and Scotty, because saving kind of refers to conversion, but actually just moving people, helping people along the spectrum. So we'll look at missiology. How do you do missions? And I'm not a theologian, but I do have a master's in biblical literature, so that helps. And certainly we want to be culturally sensitive. What is the culture of the group that we're talking to or the person that we're working with? I'm going to talk about some work by Richard Swinburne in which he uses mathematics and probability theory to help formulate a cumulative case for Christian belief. I'm going to talk about some work by George Ellis and his recent article on possibility spaces to help scientists, in particular scientists, think about including meaning and purpose as fundamental to the universe. And then an experiment that Douglas Gavett proposes, a devotional experiment we'll get into. And then my book, Hacking the Cosmos, is geared towards engineers and encouraging a reverse engineering approach towards nature and understanding the deeper questions that go behind it. And the other thing that my pastor helped me think about was, you know, I thought one of the toughest questions I was going to have here at the end was, well, how's this working for you? How many scientists and engineers have you converted? And I thought, well, my pastor helped me to think again about this spectrum of belief and how even the work that I do at ORU, working with students, these students are forming their worldviews. And so when I get feedback from students, it shows me that they're moving in a positive direction. Their faith is being strengthened by this. That's good, feedback. And so we'll look at some student reactions. So you certainly want to be relevant to the culture you're trying to bring the gospel to, right? You want to speak their language. What's the language of scientists and engineers? Mathematics, right? What do they value? Obviously, evidence from nature is going to be very important to them. We want to focus on common experiences that we've all had. See if you can't break down barriers to faith. And you want to be able to give good reasons for the scientists and engineers to believe. They look for rational belief. Not that they're immune to willful disobedience or more emotional things, but they focus more on rational arguments. And then think about taking a scientific approach to faith. One good book that I had one of my students read and give me summary on was God's Mechanics, How Scientists and Engineers Make Sense of Religion. And Cosmo Magno is the author of that book. That's a good one. It talked about the language of scientists and engineers, and Galileo, I always show this to my students in the freshman engineering class, Galileo said, we don't understand the language of this other great book that we have. I'm talking about the universe. you can't understand it unless you learn the language in which it is written. It is written in the language of mathematics. So even if my freshman students don't like math, I try to encourage them that there's so much beauty and power in mathematics that you're going to end up loving it in the end. I teach a course on the history of quantitative thought, which is really the history and philosophy of mathematics, and I use my book, Hacking the Cosmos, but I also use books by Mario Livio. He's got a mathematician. They like that book the best. It's got great stories in there. But then I also use these two books by Richard Swinburne, Philosopher of Religion at Oxford in the second half of the 20th century, probably the most renowned philosopher of religion. He wrote a book called The Existence of God, and then another one called The Resurrection of God Incarnate. And this is a two-step apologetic on the cumulative case for a Christian worldview. And it's like he's addressing scientists in this book, because he's using confirmation theory to try to evaluate these two questions of God's existence and the identity and resurrection of Jesus Christ. So he uses probability theory. And for example, in his first book, he says, let H be the hypothesis that there is a God, and let E be evidence, a particular kind of evidence. And he goes through all the different categories of evidence. So the phenomenon to be explained and other relevant observational data is this evidence. Where mu k would be background knowledge, just general information about what there is in the world and how it works. And so what would be a reasonable estimate for the probability that the hypothesis is true, given the evidence, the specific evidence at hand, and the background knowledge that you already know about the universe? And so how does one develop such an estimate for this? Well, Bayes' theorem. Maybe you already know about Bayes' theorem and confirmation theory, but it goes like this. The probability that H is true given D is the ratio of two product of two probabilities and another probability, where I think the best way to think about this is the probability that H is true given D some data is the ratio of the probability of D given H over the probability of D, that ratio, times the prior probability that H would be true if there was no data that you're looking at. And so in our language here that we've been looking at for this hypothesis of theism being true, another way to think about it is H is rendered more probable by observational evidence E and background evidence or background knowledge A. And the key thing here is that this ratio of P of E given H of K over P of E given K, that ratio is interesting to look at in terms of the evidence, because it's like, well, what's the probability that you would get this kind of evidence if the hypothesis is true, divided by the probability that you would get this kind of evidence without consideration of the hypothesis. So, I don't have time to go into all of this. But if you want, you can get Swinburne's books and look at how he looks at all of these different categories of evidence. And in his first book, he comes to the conclusion that this probability, if you put the prior probability of God's existence at like 10%, which I think he claims is conservative, and then and the probability that you would get the kind of evidence that we see here listed above, given that hypothesis is true, is pretty reasonable. But the probability that you would get this kind of evidence without consideration of the hypothesis is very small. So this is what he comes up with for God's existence, just based on the evidence from nature. And there's some criticism you can bring with regard to, you know, where does he come up with these numbers? But I think it's an interesting way for students who have never thought, you know, this rationally about their faith. It's a good way, I think, for them to categorize the evidence. And so that's just the first step, and I'm going to rush through the second step, but if you like probability theory, you're going to love this, because now he says in the second step, the hypothesis is the resurrection of God incarnate. The evidence is the unique life of Jesus Christ. K now is the knowledge from nature that we have in the first step, and T is the hypothesis of theism. And again, I don't have time to go through all this. I want to get to some other examples. But he breaks these down in very interesting ways. And I'm going to rush through and let you look at this later if you're interested. But he comes up with a probability that Jesus Christ was God incarnate and rose from the dead bodily as 97% probable. And it really falls out of this idea that how in the world would you have this kind of person do these kinds of things and not be God incarnate? And not. So, if you're interested in that, get Swinburne's books. I highly recommend it. And the students always pretty good, give me pretty good feedback on this. For example, the senior engineering student said, Swinburne offers a new perspective in thinking about matters of faith by showing there is value in using a scientific approach to show matters of faith to be more probabilistic than some may contend. Now, I feel more secure in my faith in God, Jesus, and the resurrection. It gave me a whole new perspective on how to base my own faith, as well as providing a roadmap to introduce and defend that faith to others of like mind and perspective. Now, I think he's talking about scientists and engineers there. A sophomore engineering student said, Swinburne's book is an excellent tool for sharing the gospel with STEM people. I enjoyed understanding the author's perspective and the mathematical explanation for God's existence because it was something entirely new for me. Understanding the book's arguments for God's existence has shown me a new way to see God and his creation and a new reason to trust in him. This excites me as an engineering professor at a Christian university. It makes me want to keep coming back and teaching year after year after year because we're in the Bible Belt there in Oklahoma. And I just don't think a lot of our students who come from Christian schools and even public high schools have ever really been challenged to think about their faith in these kinds of analytical, scientific, rational ways. A lot of them have just been taught, you know, blind faith, believe the Bible. So they find this pretty refreshing. I came across another really good example that I found back in 21, and I actually thought this was so significant that I gave an engineering seminar on it to all the engineering students at ORU. George Ellis wrote an article on the philosophical problems in cosmology, a deep dive into the foundations of cosmology. And it doesn't sound that interesting, maybe, unless you're a cosmologist, but if you know George Ellis, he was a Templeton Prize winner, but also a Nobel Prize winner. He worked with Stephen Hawking on very interesting cosmological and astronomical stuff. And he wrote, first of all, if you think about philosophical cosmology as opposed to physical cosmology, given all this evidence about the nature of physical cosmology, what does it have to say about the broader nature of cosmology, its relation to meaning and purpose and life? And how does the scientific evidence interact with other areas of knowledge such as philosophy, humanities, arts, and theology? And before I go any further with George Ellis's article, I want to just say that it seemed to me as I was reading this article that George Ellis was trying to move people who were at the kind of the very beginning of the spectrum forward a little bit in the positive direction. People who had no belief in meaning or purpose in the universe and just complete naturalistic perspective. Because as you'll see what he says here, George Ellis writes, I claim that the deep structure of the universe is timeless, eternal possibility spaces. He defined this term of a platonic nature. These underlie the nature of what is possible in the physical universe and what is not. These are a way of re-expressing the nature of the laws of physics in terms of the space of possible physical outcomes. And he goes further to say, In other words, what can be in the universe and what agents can do in the universe? And I pointed out that these are very closely related to affordances, what I defined in my book, Hacking the Cosmos, but I'll talk about that maybe later. He goes on to say that most importantly and remarkably, biological possibility spaces include the possibility of agency consciousness and the symbolic capacity that allows society and technology to flourish. There is also an abstract space of all possible thoughts underlying all the thoughts that intelligent beings actually have. This space is the foundation of our mental capacities, with some of these possibilities being realized in each individual brain via our brain functioning during our lifetime. So the key methodological question for cosmology is, what kind of data is relevant? Should we only take into account the hard sciences? What about everyday life? Should the nature of biological possibility spaces also be considered relevant? My position is that biological and mental emergent phenomena are key irreducible aspects of reality, just as much data about the nature of the cosmos as science. They are key aspects of the way things are. Data about everyday life and associated possibilities is data about the universe. Thus, in my view, we should take into account data not only about physics and the physical universe, but also data about life, including our mental and social universes. If we take this viewpoint, the really deep issue in cosmology is this: why do these possibility spaces exist and have the nature they do? It is a simple observational fact, he writes, that the world is teeming with purpose: biological, economic, political, social, scientific. Why and how does all this purpose exist? At a deep level, it exists because physical, biological, and mental possibility spaces allow it to exist. And here is the thing: possibilities that are realized include visions of great art and scientific achievement, poverty and wealth, compassion and selfishness, and above all, concepts of love and hate, good and evil. These are possibility spaces that George Ellis is arguing should not be left out of our scientific understandings. Moral and ethical virtues and evils are part of the mental possibility spaces which can be realized here or on any other planet. They can be thought about because they are included in the mental possibility space and have been there since time began. Humans have demonstrably contemplated purpose and meaning and ethics for millennia, and their existence is data on how things are. The existence of these possibility spaces is part of the deep structure of the cosmos. In that sense, meaning is built into the foundations of existence. So, you can see that he's addressing just meaning and purpose. I mean, he's nowhere near Jesus Christ on the spectrum of Christian belief, right? But this is a part of, I mean, it appeared to me, and this is what I was showing in our engineering seminar to my students. This is an example of missions work that a scientist is engaged in, because even though it's not Christian per se, it is arguing for meaning and purpose in the universe. But then why Christianity? And this is where Douglas Guy Bett, I think, did a good article. Even though George Ellis delivers a powerful argument for objective meaning and purpose in the universe, why choose Christianity over other competing worldviews? And so Douglas Guy Bett and the cumulative case for Christianity come into play here in terms of other ways of knowing. And Guy Bett is a professor of biology, a professor of philosophy at Biola University. And he presented a paper that I just want to cut to this seventh step in his approach here, the cumulative case, which is this inertia-breaking or devotional experiment. And he argues that the case is cogent, but belief may still be difficult due to non-rational causes. And you need an inertia-breaking kind of experiment, a devotional experiment, to break a habit of unbelief. You need to taste and see that the Lord is good. and simple actions practiced regularly help orient one to God. And so this may or may not result in a dramatic religious experience, but if one talks to God, in other words, prays, and sees if it has any effect, if God answers, one can often experience a reconciliation with their Maker. So that's an example of a devotional experiment that came to mind when I was thinking of talking to scientists about how they might evaluate belief in God. Of course, I want to mention, I dare not leave out Reasons to Believe in BioLogos or a couple of groups that have really done well, I think, and shown a great track record in helping to remove barriers from scientists and engineers and other techies that might stand in the way of belief. So, like recently, they had a good collaboration on this book. And then, in particular with engineers, my book, Hacking the Cosmos, How Reverse Engineering Uncovers Organization, Ingenuity, and the Care of a Maker, is what I've been using in Intro to Engineering and a couple other courses at ORU. And this is affordance-based reverse engineering is a particular kind of dissection and analysis of existing systems. Affordances are simply relationships that result in some potential action that can be taken. Very simply, that chair you're in affords sitting. It also affords mobility because it's lighter and affords stacking. These are affordances. Engineers create affordances for their customers. A cell phone like this has hundreds, probably thousands of affordances associated with it. So when you break something apart to understand how it works and where it came from, what was in the mind of the original engineer, you look for those relationships. You're basically looking at affordances. How many minutes? So we look at the reverse engineering approach to natural systems as well as artificial systems, and then think about the practical and philosophical implications of that. In a nutshell, when you see nested and layered affordances in nature, it just leads you to thinking about them being designed that way, that there's a mastermind behind it who planned it that way. And I was able to actually very quickly, while I was on sabbatical last year, I got an invitation to write a chapter on reverse engineering for a book by InTech Open, this open source publisher. And so I wrote a chapter basically summarizing Hacking the Cosmos. It's affordance-based reverse engineering of natural systems. It came out just this year. So if you don't want to read the whole book, Hacking the Cosmos, you can look at it and see this one chapter, this summary. But while I was writing that chapter, I felt like I was doing missions work. It was very weird. So that's one example. A student said, before reading Hacking the Cosmos, I stayed away from connecting God and science. However, while reading it, I learned about affordances, which has made the most immediate impact on my life. I could not help being amazed at how precise our universe is and that the discovery of entropy has afforded us the ability to observe that precision. Dr. Halsmer's breakdown of complex systems in terms of affordances observed in nature fortified my faith. And another sophomore student, the book not only made me see God through a new lens, but it made me feel a stronger passion for engineering. Understanding God's perfection through the little details of the human body. Oh, this is a biomedical engineer student. And how engineers many times have needed to reverse engineer processes that happen in the body to solve many complex problems is something that's made me more interested in the profession and more understanding of the Creator. Let me stop there. I'm probably out of time. Yeah, I have another, a longer feedback from a student here, but if the question comes up then where he's addressing that, I'll go into what he said. What do you think? I'm interested to know.
It's a great time for questions. Again, for anybody who wasn't here last time, please wait for the microphone so that it could be on the recording.
I love the idea about a test devotional, if you will. Taste and see that the Lord is good. But to get to students and colleagues that are hurt so bad in terms of being rejected and told that this was just ignorant and so on. Do you have another idea to get even to the point of doing a test devotion because of that hurt?
Yeah, that's good. And I skipped over what Douglas Guy Vett recommends. And I just jumped to that one because of time. But if you look, he recommends these steps would go before this inertia breaking experiment, this devotional type of experiment. And so I think this is a logical, reasonable set of steps for dialoguing with a naturalist or a scientist or engineer who's not a believer yet. I'm criticized sometimes for, a lot of people will say, just give them Jesus. Just tell them about the resurrection. But I think a two-step apologetic is more helpful with some scientists and engineers, because unless they see the evidence for a maker, then a resurrection from the dead, they see that as ludicrous. But if there is evidence for a maker, then an incarnation and a resurrection starts to make a little more sense.
Thanks for a really interesting talk. I hope this is an easy question. George Ellis has like a dozen books. Which one were you referencing when you talked about?
That was an article, not a book. It was an article from 2021 on possibility spaces. If you just
George Ellis, possibility spaces.
Yeah, if you Google that, you should be able to find it.
Okay,
2021.
Thanks.
Another couple minutes, if anybody has a burning question. Dominic, I'm curious, this is a slight step removed, but as a biologist and you're an engineer, I wonder, I feel like there's different conceptions of God's working, and in that quote from your biomedical student talking about the precise, sort of precisely engineered human body, I see that on the one hand, and yet also believe that it was created over generations of time through a slow accumulation of changes.
Yeah.
And so I wonder how you as an engineer kind of help bridge that that sort of tension that sometimes arises.
Yeah, it's definitely a tension at Oral Roberts University, because many students come from a young Earth, a creationist perspective where evolution has been denied and denigrated. But the cool thing about a reverse engineering approach is you can actually gain some insight on how these systems came about by looking at their history. I show the chromosome number 2 and the evidence for this end-to-end fusion of these two chromosomes, perhaps from chimpanzee chromosomes, and now we see that evidence of that fusion in humans, cells, and it's amazing to me that they've never seen that before and never heard about that evidence. So that's just one example, but they are intrigued by the reverse engineering approach, and especially when they see that even though it's based on systems that are currently in existence and we dissect them as best we can and analyze what happened in the past, you can still come up with some good evidence for an evolutionary perspective just by looking at the systems that they currently exist. So it's a challenge though. Do we have one more minute?
Yes, we have room for one more.
Would love to share this last feedback from this student, because Joshua Williams was a PK, a pastor's kid, and he had a crisis in faith when he came to ORU. I hope it comes across in his statement here. It says, I was raised believing that six-day young Earth creation was the only position that a good Christian could really take. However, as I began to look into the cases presented by both sides, I found that there were many compelling evidences for an old Earth and an old universe in cosmology, geology, biology, paleontology, and archaeology. Studying science and coming to a conclusion that I agreed with the scientific consensus, I was left at somewhat of an impasse, for I still was not sure how well Scripture could be reconciled with many of these well-supported scientific theories. At the same time, I was facing many other questions about my faith and desperately looking for stronger reasons to substantiate it, while being told that it was wrong to question such things. This began to make it seem as if there were no good reasons to base faith on, and I didn't see how it could be good to hold a belief that wasn't supported with good reason. Then I went to college. I heard a professor that I held in high regard presenting inflationary Big Bang cosmology and some arguments for God from the fine-tuning of the universe. Seeing this, a Christian professor who accepted the Big Bang helped me to recognize that scripture really could be compatible with science. Furthermore, once I was open to the idea, I found that this story of cosmology that I found immensely fascinating could even bolster my faith in God, seeing not only the apparent fine-tuning, but also the sheer beauty in the model was something that I couldn't help but feel pointed to a creator with immeasurable wisdom and foresight. And that quote was taken from an article that we wrote based on the BioLogos grant that I worked on and Catherine knows about. It was an article called Sailing the Seas to Scientific Literacy Without Shipwrecking Faith in America's Bible Belt. If you're interested in that, it was presented at the Science and Society Conference and published in the International Journal of Science and Society in 2015.
All right, Dominic, thank you so much. Let's thank our students.